I'm a geologist from the state of Wisconsin, where the thought of earthquakes is kind of a novelty. I mean, isn't that interesting? And then people kind of live where there are earthquakes. That seems kind of stupid, you know? Why would people want to do that? Every time I say something like that, somebody mentions, well, don't you live where there are tornadoes and things of that nature? And, well, yeah, I suppose, but
you see those
I suppose it is what you get used to, you know, what you think about. But I want to talk a little bit, show about a half-hour video on earthquake, which does a really nice job of giving some background information about earthquakes. And then I thought we'd just spend a little bit of time talking about them. I'll tell you a little bit about the worst earthquake in North America, and it has nothing whatsoever to do with the West. It's kind of interesting. I'll talk a little bit about that and why there might have been an earthquake there. And I'm going to show you some materials here, which you're welcome to come up and take a look at. I'm going out today. We're done, and so if anybody wants to take these, they may, or because I'm going to not carry them with me on the boat, because I can always get these. These are available on the internet, and I'll give you the internet address where if you want to follow this up a little bit, you can just kind of find it and kind of play with it and go link to link wherever you want and find some of these same kind of things that are kind of interesting. So I think we'll start with the video. Maybe I should explain. I'm a geologist. I work with the Wisconsin Geological and Natural History Survey. This is like a state geological survey. I work a lot with mineral resource issues, mining issues in the state of Wisconsin. Very, very controversial. Wisconsin has a very rich mineral endowment and has extremely strict environmental regulations. It has a fairly long mining history that has been kind of conveniently forgotten in the last couple of decades. Environmentalism has been much more important in Wisconsin, and it creates a really interesting tension in the state. Last evening, I talked about one of the mining proposals in the state of Wisconsin, the kind of controversy that proposal has created. My job is to work with people from all sides of a particular question to provide them with information about what is going on. My so-called expertise in the state is in how we regulate mining. And so I know about that, and I inform people about how it's done, whether they're an environmental group, whether they're a local unit of government, and whatever. I work with them, or a mining company themselves, work with them to try to understand how we regulate, what the rules are, how to play the game, if you will. Citizens generally, oftentimes, are not much empowered in terms of playing the game. It is a game oftentimes played by lawyers and some fairly well-financed people, whether they're environmentalists, whether they're from the mining company, or whatever. But at any rate, what I want to do today, however, I get tired of talking about those kinds of issues and thinking about that kind of controversy. So what I wanted to do when I came out to Holden, at least part of the time, is talk about some of the things that got me into the game of geology in the first place, sort of remind myself why I do this kind of thing, why I'm interested in this. So I've talked about volcanoes and mineral resources in general and the geology of the area, just basic geologic, kind of a reminder to me of why I got into the interest in this. Earthquakes is another one that's one of these kind of ooh-ah kinds of phenomena in geology and captures the imagination of people over time. But let me start the video. This is a kind of, public broadcasting system quality, PBS quality video. It's actually quite good, and I think we'll find it pretty interesting. And let's see if I can started.
Estaremos dando un poco de la luz de Cristo. Y antes de su tema, vamos a tener
7 de la mañana, 18 minutos, 7 de la mañana, 19 minutos, 48 minutos, 10:45 de minuto. Sigue temblando un poquitito, pero pues vamos a tomarlo con una gran tranquilidad. Vamos a esperar un segundo para poder hablar.
Historian Will Durand once observed that civilization exists by geological consent, subject to change without notice. Durand may not have had earthquakes specifically in mind when he made that statement, but it is difficult to imagine a more cataclysmic event than a major earthquake. Ancient mythology held that tremors occurred due to the movements of giant animals beneath the earth. While science has since proved such notions incorrect, these myths did contain at least one element of truth. The cause for the abruptly shifting land does reside deep below our feet. But instead of the land sitting on a mythological beast, we ride atop a gigantic heat-transporting machine that keeps deep rock flowing and churning. Radioactive decay generates the heat energy which ultimately powers movements of Earth's rocky tectonic plates. The friction between the rough edges of these slowly moving segments of the Earth's lithosphere results in a series of jerky starts and stops, which is the direct cause of most major earthquakes. The same heat engine that produces earthquakes is the driving force raising the world's great mountain ranges. If this uplift did not take place, the relentless force of erosion would reduce the Earth's landscape to a single flat plain. Without the present range of elevations, rivers would lose their principal sources of water. The land would ultimately erode down to tide level. And most of the diversity in the world's flora and fauna would disappear. And yet, while there are indirect benefits to living in a world with earthquakes, it's the capacity of tremors to violently disrupt human activity that commands our attention.
Earthquakes often occur here, on the San Andreas Fault in California. This fault is actually the boundary between two tectonic plates, the North American and Pacific plate. In 1857, this segment of the San Andreas caused a massive earthquake. The ground on either side of the fault shifted suddenly and violently, moving as much as 4 meters. Instruments to measure the strength of the quake didn't exist at the time, but estimates based on eyewitness accounts of the damage range as high as 8.2 on the Richter scale. Since then, California has experienced several devastating earthquakes. In fact, thousands of earthquakes on hundreds of different faults shake California each year. But earthquakes are not just a California story. They occur throughout the world. In regions that are densely populated and where construction practices are primitive, the destruction and loss of life from a powerful earthquake can be almost incomprehensible. In 1990, 50,000 people died in Iran. The year before, 25,000 people were killed in Armenia. And in China, hundreds of thousands of people were killed in a single earthquake in 1976. Earthquakes are shock waves. They are produced when rocks break and vibrate when two blocks of the Earth's crust slide past one another. This usually occurs along a fault, which is a zone of weakness in the Earth's crust. Movement of the Earth's crust causes stress to accumulate in the rocks of the fault zone. I can feel the stress accumulating in my hands as I try to slide them past one another. The rocks will eventually break when the accumulated stress exceeds the strength of the rocks in the fault. The movement of the tectonic plates is the principal source of stress in the Earth's crust. The stress that accumulates over hundreds or even thousands of years is released in an instant as an earthquake. Geologists study the mechanics of earthquake behavior in order to develop an understanding of where and when earthquakes are most likely to happen.
Most of the energy in an earthquake is expended when blocks of rock move into new positions. The energy fractures the rock, forming a plane of slip called a fault along which future earthquakes can also occur. Some energy generates frictional heat, and a small part of the energy released creates seismic waves. These waves can be categorized according to the form they take and the speed at which they travel.
Those that travel in such a way that the matter through which the waves are traveling are alternately compressed and dilatated, these are called P waves. The reason they're called P waves is because these are the first ones, the primary waves, to arrive at a seismograph. S waves, which are sometimes called secondary waves or shear waves, are waves which travel by a wave-like motion where the matter is vibrating up and down at right angles to the direction that the wave energy is being propagated. This causes a shear stress to develop in the rocks through which it's traveled, why they're called shear waves or S waves. The S waves travel somewhat slower than the P waves, with a difference in speed about 2 kilometers a second.
This difference in velocity between P and S waves is highly significant. It enables seismologists to calculate the precise location where an earthquake has occurred.
If one lies close to the epicenter of an earthquake, the P and the S waves will not have had enough time really to become separate from one another as they travel through the earth. They arrive all at once, and the earthquake is felt as a sharp jolt. If, however, one lies at a great distance from the epicenter, the P waves will have far outraced the S waves and so arrive much earlier than the S waves do. The time interval between the arrival of the P and the S waves thus is a function of the distance to the source, the epicenter. Having a single seismograph record showing the time interval between the arrival of S and P waves is not adequate for locating the epicenter. It simply tells one how far away the earthquake occurred. The direction is still missing from this information. In order to determine that direction, one examines seismograph records from other stations in the regions as well. One can pull out a map and easily locate the epicenter by drawing circles around each respective seismic station, representing the distance inferred to the source of the earthquake based on the time interval between S and P waves. And where these circles intersect, bingo, that's your source. That's where the earthquake energy first reached the Earth's surface.
In the 2nd century, Chinese built a device that could detect the initial ground motion during an earthquake. It consisted of 8 metal balls arranged around the circumference of a large sphere. If the earth shook hard enough, a small pendulum inside the sphere swung back and forth, knocking one of the balls off its stand. This indicated the direction that the earthquake vibrations came from. At the turn of the century, a more advanced device was designed, one to make a permanent record of ground motion during an earthquake. This instrument, called a duplex pendulum seismograph, recorded the shaking of the ground as a continuous squiggle on a piece of paper. It was this device that recorded the ground motion of the 1906 San Francisco earthquake. The invention of a device that could accurately measure the strength of an earthquake was a significant scientific achievement. These modern seismographs operate on the same general principles as the early pendulum instruments, but they are much more sensitive. Not only do they record vibrations, but they can be used to measure earthquake strength and duration, and also to determine the location of the earthquake almost immediately.
In 1935, California geophysicist Charles Richter combined the measure of ground motion with the distance from the earthquake's epicenter to yield a value representing the total amount of energy released during an earthquake. He called this the magnitude of the quake. The scale that Richter devised runs from magnitude -2 to infinity. Although seismologists believe that rocks can at most only store elastic energy equivalent to magnitude 9 before they snap. The smallest tremors that can be discerned by humans, feeling like the rumbling of a passing train, measure around 2.5 on the Richter scale. A magnitude of 4 is equivalent to the amount of energy released by 1,000 tons of explosives. A magnitude just above 8 represents about as much energy as produced by 201 megaton nuclear bombs. The reason for the huge jumps in energy between one unit and the next on the Richter scale is that each unit of magnitude increases logarithmically by a factor of just over 30 times more energy released.
For example, a magnitude 5 earthquake releases about 1/30th of the energy of a magnitude 6 earthquake. So to compare a magnitude 5 earthquake with the magnitude 7.1 Loma Prieta earthquake, there's a factor of about 900 in terms of the energy released between those two earthquakes. Small earthquakes really are insignificant in terms of the release of strain on the fault that is the cause of large damaging earthquakes. Small earthquakes really tell you that a fault has enough stress on it to cause bigger earthquakes.
One of the highest magnitude earthquakes ever recorded occurred in 1964 in Alaska. It registered 8.6 on the Richter scale. Fortunately, very large earthquakes are rare. Of the thousands of quakes that occur worldwide each year, only 100 or so are strong enough to destroy human life and property. And only one or two produce major geological changes. The most obvious effect of an earthquake is just that. The earth quakes and trembles. There are many different types of ground vibrations, the rapid vibrations of the primary and secondary waves, and the slower rolling motion of what are called surface waves. Near the epicenter, where all these vibrations are concentrated at the same location, ground motion is similar to the complex sea surface in an ocean storm, with waves of all sizes mixed together. But the longer waves travel faster and may not die out for hundreds of kilometers. The amount of time it takes two successive wave crests to pass a stationary point is called the waves period. For longer seismic waves, this period may be several seconds. Other materials, including buildings, have a period associated with them. In a strong gust of wind, a skyscraper will flex and bend. The time it takes for the skyscraper to oscillate back and forth once is called its natural period. When the period of a seismic wave matches the natural period of a building, the seismic energy is simply added to the oscillation of the building, wave after wave. As a result, the swaying of the building increases dramatically. Other buildings of different heights will not be similarly affected because their natural periods are different. An example of this type of amplification occurs when a child is pushed on a swing. A gentle push in time with the swing's natural period sends the swing higher and higher. In the 1985 Mexican earthquake, seismic surface wave periods matched the natural periods of Mexico City buildings between 10 and 14 stories high. Structures in this size range were seriously damaged. Given the destructive power of many earthquakes, geologists hope to develop the ability to forecast quakes in time to warn any people who might be in danger. But to do this requires a better understanding of earthquake behavior. One pastoral stretch of the San Andreas Fault near Parkfield, California, has been especially prone to earthquakes. Since 1857, residents of this area have been jolted by moderately strong earthquakes on an average of once every 21 to 22 years. Besides recurring at fairly regular intervals, Parkfield earthquakes also resemble one another in their magnitudes, lengths of fault rupture, and epicenter locations. For this reason, the Parkfield area seems like an ideal setting for an earthquake research project. Geophysicists are using a sophisticated array of devices to closely monitor the rocks along the fault. The goal is to spot any changes that might signal an impending earthquake. Evelyn Roloffs is the chief scientist overseeing the Parkfield earthquake prediction experiment.
The Parkfield experiment has three goals. One goal is to try to issue a short-term prediction of the Parkfield earthquake, and that would, if successful, be the first time we've ever done something like that in this country. The second goal is to record the details of the earthquake generation process in as much detail as possible. And the third goal is to take advantage of the fact that we'll have a moderate earthquake to record some of the effects of the earthquake, such as the amount of shaking that occur at different distances from the fault.
One of the most fundamental aspects of the Parkfield experiment focuses on the structure of the San Andreas Fault itself. To learn more about this structure, geophysicists have set up the VibroSize project. At the heart of this effort is a specially equipped truck that shakes the ground, triggering waves of seismic energy. Radiating into the earth, the seismic waves move at different velocities through different rock types. Analysis of the velocity changes makes it possible to unravel the intricacies of the subsurface geologic structure.
As the waves penetrate the earth, they are reflected and refracted off the various rock layers. And by measuring first the direct wave, which travels directly from the source to receivers, we can get the velocity of the rocks. And then by looking at the later arriving reflected and refracted scattered waves, we can see possibly where the structure changes and where the layering beneath the earth is.
With an understanding of the geologic structure of the fault zone, geophysicists set up other experiments to measure movement along the fault. One device that can detect movement in a very specific localized area is called a creep meter. Each creep meter consists of a wire stretched across the fault between two fixed points. Whenever the fault slips, the length of wire between the two points changes, recording the amount of motion along the fault. Although the creep meter only covers about a 10-meter zone, it runs at very high sensitivity and continuously monitors any fault motion at the surface. To derive the same kinds of information as provided by a creep meter, but over a wider area, geophysicists use what's known as an alignment array. This involves setting up markers, then conducting surveys across the San Andreas Fault to determine the local slip rate, the width of the slip zones, and patterns of deformation near the fault trace.
180 degrees, 11 minutes, 3.07.
ES2, 180 degrees, 24 minutes.
The alignment array surveys are also useful in helping scientists determine the best places to install creep meters.
The alignment array is similar to the creep meter in that it's measuring fault slip right at the surface trace. However, the creep meter is a continuous monitoring device for the center of that slip area, whereas the alignment array goes much farther away from the fault to be sure that we're not missing some important slip on auxiliary fractures out to the side. The alignment array, of course, is we only get data when we make surveys, whereas the creep meter can be run continuously, and we can look at that every day to see how much the center of this zone has actually moved.
Another important component in the park field effort to better understand the mechanics of faulting is the geometer. This shoots rays of laser light at 18 reflectors set up like the spokes of a wheel on the hills around Parkfield.
We put reflectors at different points around the valley, and we take measurements to those. So we keep track of how long it takes that light to go out to that reflector and come back with some sophisticated equipment and computers. And by knowing how fast the light travels and knowing how long it took it to get there and get back, we can calculate a measurement to within a fraction of a millimeter on a 9-kilometer line when the conditions are really good.
This network of light is so sensitive that it can detect the slightest bending of rocks along the fault zone. The geometer system covers a much broader area than either a creep meter or an alignment array survey.
They're all designed to look at the same kind of thing with different sensitivities and at different scales, so they all contribute to an understanding of the mechanics of the faulting.
Before the next Parkfield earthquake, scientists hope to see an acceleration of the slip that occurs on the San Andreas Fault between earthquakes. If that acceleration takes place at the surface, it can be detected directly by a creep meter. But geologists must use other techniques to detect deep movement along the fault that does not appear as slip at the surface. As stress accumulates in the earth, groundwater will respond by rising or falling. This can be measured in water wells that have been installed by members of the Parkfield research team. A sudden drop in water level, for example, is sometimes observed as the ground swells and cracks in the days preceding an earthquake. Seismologists studying Parkfield are also interested in measuring foreshocks, the seismic activity that precedes an earthquake. To do this requires a detailed network of seismometers, which the Parkfield team has set up. Tiny earthquakes are common occurrences along most active faults. But shortly before a large quake, the frequency and distribution of small shocks may change.
Being the person who looks at the seismicity, I'm expecting to see some changes in the patterns of the earthquake. The earthquakes occur in the fault zone in a fairly complicated manner. Some places the activity is shallow, some places the activity is deep. As we get more detailed information about the fault zone, we see certain knots or clusters that are active. What we're expecting to see is that the larger earthquakes will start, magnitude 2s, 2.5, 3s, and they'll start migrating down the fault zone towards the area that will fail first in that earthquake. This is the pattern that's been seen in 34 and in 66, and that we're keeping a very close eye on the activity to see if that kind of activity occurs again.
In the case of the Parkfield experiment, the data obtained in the field are then regularly transmitted by satellite to the U.S. Geological Survey in Menlo Park, California, for analysis. Here, the data are monitored by scientists for any unusual activity. Depending on the extent of such activity, the Parkfield research team may declare any one of four prearranged alert levels. These alert levels indicate the probability of a sizable earthquake occurring at Parkfield within the following 72 hours. If and when there is a high-level alert, the USGS will inform the California Office of Emergency Services, which will then issue a warning to the public. This warning signifies that the seismologists at the USGS in Menlo Park believe there is at least a 30% chance a magnitude 6 or higher earthquake will occur in Parkfield during the next 72 hours. There are no guarantees, of course, that the Parkfield research team will be able to predict the next sizable quake in that region in time to issue a warning. but members of the Parkfield team believe that their project is valuable, even if a short-term warning is not issued.
It's enabling us to record the details of fault slip to a degree that they've never been recorded before. And if there are precursors recorded by instruments that aren't involved in the alert level scheme, we'll be able to detect them after the fact, and then maybe we can use them to issue a prediction of the next moderate earthquake in California.
In the meantime, the data recording device is at Parkfield, and the scientists at Menlo Park maintain their seismic vigil.
Along the San Andreas Fault, and on active faults all over the world, rocks of the Earth's crust continuously try to slide past one another. This causes the rocks in the fault zone to bend and deform, accumulating tremendous tectonic stress in the process. Eventually, this massive store of energy will exceed the breaking strength of the rocks, triggering an earthquake. There is no doubt that this will occur. The principal questions are when and how strong the resulting earthquake will be. While earthquake research continues, the hopes of a reliable short-term forecasting system are still probably decades away. This task is complicated by the fact that each fault is unique, and successive earthquakes on a given fault can vary considerably. In the meantime, there are tangible steps that we can take to prepare ourselves for the earthquakes that will surely occur. Nature has forced us to live with these sudden releases of energy, but knowledge gives us the power and the chance to survive them.
Did somebody reach up on the back of that thing? There's a button on the back, on that side, right where you are, on the back. I get a kick out of the drama in the voice. A lot of work is being done, and I think the bottom line of all that is that in many respects we still don't have a clue as to how to go about predicting whether these things will come. So it's a matter of just continuing to gather data and look for patterns. I just want to, the video itself really focuses on the San Andreas Fault, a particular type of fault, particular type of movement. And this is no surprise to you having listened to that, but basically the idea that there is a weakness in looking down on top of the earth, a weakness along a line, movement along that line, which is strain. Strain is building up over time, and then when it is released in the form of stress, actual movement takes place, then it releases a lot of energy. You heard him talk about epicenters. Epicenter is the projection on the Earth's surface right above where the fault, the actual movement within the Earth takes place. The point where that movement within the Earth takes place is called the focus. You'll hear geologists talk about shallow earthquakes, deep earthquakes. They're talking about where in the Earth crust did the actual movement take place. Where was the focus? Directly above the focus is what's called the epicenter. So energy is radiated out in the course of, in the form of stress, is radiated out when movement has occurred, and then goes out from the epicenter. Just to drive home the point just a little bit, that the different types of earthquake waves travel at different speeds. So the difference between a P wave and an S wave for a shallow focus earthquake is somewhere around 2 kilometers per second. So if you know the time between when you first see a P wave arrive at a seismograph and when the first S wave arrive, it'll have a different look to it. Well, if you know that time, now you've got a chance to do distance. So from where you are, you can draw that circle around that point at that distance. And then you've got to have at least basically three to be able to pin down the exact location of an epicenter. But one thing that I don't think the video does perhaps a good enough job talking about is how all this somehow ties into plate tectonics. And I think that's important for us to understand here in the Pacific Northwest. I've got some things here from Rainier and Mount St. Helens that I think are kind of interesting when we look at it. But basically what's happening at the Earth's surface, of course, and in the upper Midwest, is that you have a plate, the Pacific plate, and actually off the coast of Washington is called the Juan de Fuca plate. And it is going underneath the North American plate. The movement, the sense of movement is in this direction. And what is happening, now I need to put some depth on here. Let's say we're down 50 kilometers or so in the Earth at this point. What's happening is that this plate is breaking, is failing, is faulting, and it is stimulating the movement of energy up into the Earth. And of course, in the area of the North American plate, what's also happening is it's also releasing not only a seismic energy, but also some heat energy. You're creating fractures. Hot material, which is kind of held in place by the pressure of the Earth, is being released along fractures, and of course then you get volcanic activity in the North American plate, and this is considered to be the Cascades for the sake of argument in this example. So it's interesting to look then at the seismic activity beneath the mountains. Now, I promise to give you this one address. For those of you who have access to the internet, if you go to this address, www.geophys.washington.edu, you get to a site, a website, which has a whole bunch of links to other sites that can bring up information about what's going on beneath Mount Rainier, what's going on beneath Mount St. Helens, and all kinds of activity related to seismic activity in the in the Northwest, Pacific Northwest. If you have access to that, it's really kind of a fun thing to look at. And I've got some examples examples here to show you. This kind of hard to see from where you are, but I'll leave these up here. If this is a kind of a profile of Mount St. Helens, and this is kind of a profile of Rainier, you can see that by just the darkness of it, there's a lot more earthquake activity beneath Mount St. Helens than there is beneath Mount Rainier. And if you imagine that the length of this dark streak is related to the depth beneath into the Earth, you can see that Mount St. Helens has a lot more deeper earthquakes beneath it than does Mount Rainier. The sort of nature of the seismic activity is different. What does that mean? I'm not really sure. Usually seismic activity in this particular location is related to the movement of magma beneath the volcano, and you can see that there's a difference in the quality of that seismic activity. And you can look at these materials. I'll leave these out. Again, if you got access to the internet, you can always look those up and get the latest printout. Before we came into the village, stopped off in Seattle. My daughter, who works in library science at UW, we went on the internet and pulled some of the stuff off And you can get the latest catalog of seismic events. Kind of interesting. This is for the went from May 28th through June 27th when we came in, and gives you the location of the earthquake and the magnitude of the earthquake, and it's kind of interesting whether it was felt or not, and that kind of thing. It's kind of interesting information. Is this a seismically active area here, Holden? Interestingly enough, there was an earthquake here, the epicenter for which was between here and Lucerne, more close to Lucerne than from Holden. I don't have any information of the strength of that earthquake. It took place in the early 60s, 1960s, 62, 63, but it was an earthquake that was felt up in this area. This particular area is not an incredibly active area seismically. Just to the west of us is much more active. But there is seismic activity here. This is a diagram which shows with the big dots, and the size of the dot is related to the number. The last 20 events that exceeded 2.0 on a Richter scale. And you can see there's Ellensburg, Spokane, here's Glacier Peak, this is Lake Chelan coming up in here on the other side of, well, on the other side of Lake Chelan, like, oh, maybe 15 kilometers the other side of Lake Chelan, there's been a number of earthquakes. But most of the earthquakes are to the west of us in this area. So I invite you to take a look at some of these things.
How far west?
Oh, Puget Sound area.
Yeah, that's what I was afraid you
were going to say. Yeah, it's not that far west. I mean, if you're in Holden, it's pretty far west. But if you live in Seattle, it's underneath you. So, again, I don't understand why people want to live in those kind of places. Let me just tell you a quick little anecdote, and then I really would kind of like to hear if you have any anecdotes. I'd like to hear earthquake stories, if you've got them. We have some time before we have to break. The strongest earthquake that geologists think occurred in North America was the earthquake that took place in the New Madrid area of North America in 1811, 1812. The reason it's 1811 and 1812 was probably about three or four earthquakes of very large size took place over a period of a few months near New Madrid, latter part of 1811, going into the early part of 1812. Now I'll really test my drawing ability here, but if this is the Mississippi River, and let's say this is the New Orleans for the sake of argument, and this is the Ohio River coming in. Does any of this look real at all? There's Lake, what is that? Lake Michigan, Superior, Huron, Erie, you know, the Great Lakes. So this is the confluence of the Ohio River and the Mississippi River. And right in here is a place called New Madrid. Now this is in the very, very heart of the North American continent. One of the really fascinating things when we talk about plate tectonics, and you think, boy, you can just about explain everything with plate tectonics, you know. Everything just seems to tie together. We know why there are volcanoes all around the Pacific Rim. We know why that's where most of the earthquakes are. But when you come to talk about the largest earthquake in North American history, it occurs right in the middle of the North American continent and has nothing to do, as far as we can tell, with plate tectonics. The earthquake that took place in the epicenter was just south of New Madrid. That earthquake was felt over 2.5 million square kilometers. It was felt all the way to the Rockies and all the way to the East Coast up into New England. And then north up beyond Wisconsin, up beyond New Orleans and up beyond into Mexico. It was a series of huge earthquakes. And it's very difficult to explain why they took place, but I'm going to understand why they took place. So, but this is why we think it did. What you have in the coastal plain of North America is a thick sequence of sedimentary rocks and sediments. Okay. If I could, I'm going to really take a risk here and try to draw. I don't want any comments about drawing here. Okay, so this is, if you look at the geology here, there is there's a whole area, and now I'm going to draw a cross section along this line, okay? So this is the Mississippi Delta. This is roughly, well, let's call it New Madrid area. This is what we call the coastal plain. Those are coastal plain sediments, sedimentary rock. They range in age from about 150 million years old up to more, obviously more recent times. Some are still being deposited out here, washed out here into the. There's a typical Western approach. You just absolutely cut off Mexico and everything else, I suppose. But this, so let's just look at this. Going out into the middle of the sea. If you look at this in cross-sectional view, what you see is a huge package, very thick, many tens of thousands of feet of sedimentary rocks off the edge, this point being this point right here. And then this point being this point right here. Huge sequence of rocks formed here, tens of thousands of feet thick. There is a particular type of faulting which allows this to take place. It's called growth faulting. And I'm not going to draw this that very, very well, but this growth faulting takes place. And it creates the space, if you will, to allow these kinds of thick packages of sediments to form. Now, we think what was happening is that it's in failure related to growth faults way up here that that earthquake finally took place. Basically, it doesn't have a whole lot to do with plate tectonics, but kind of interesting. Okay, that's my story. Does anybody want to say anything about earthquakes? Anybody been in an earthquake?
I'd like to follow that up a little bit. Chronicles that I've read about it said that the Mississippi flowed backwards for a period of time and measured in days, hours. Remember,
this is a, not every earthquake has this kind of phenomenon, these kinds of phenomena attached to them, but you actually, there are areas along the Mississippi which are now underwater, which were evidence was they were above and vice versa. You had tremendous ground movement here. Not every earthquake has a lot of ground movement associated. We saw some with the Anchorage earthquake in 1964. You saw that tremendous kind of ground movement there. This earthquake is believed to have had an enormous amount of ground movement associated, where you actually had reversal of the direction of rivers flowing for periods of time until it settled down and it was reestablished in its proper proper direction.
So it turned into floods and mud.
The earthquake down in Chile in 1960-61 time frame, you read accounts down there of people talk about standing on the ground. We talk about these surface waves that were kind of the last things that come through, these surface waves. Periods of like 17 to 20 seconds. Imagine that period of time from one crest to the next, to where the ground would go up like 3 meters and go down very slowly in an earthquake. Periods of like over 10 seconds, 15 to 17 second periods. Incredible motion taking place. And then ultimately failure. One of the fascinating facts, which I never had heard before, was this concept of the symmetry of earthquake waves with the motion of skyscrapers. And when you hear it, it makes sense. But when you think about it, that means that in an area where you've got a whole range of skyscrapers, it's going to be a certain group of skyscrapers that are going to be very severely damaged. And it might be the ones from 10 to 14 stories high, as it was in this particular example. That's kind of a fascinating concept. I don't know how many of us think about skyscrapers actually having a periodicity to their motion to them, but that's kind of an interesting phenomenon. So tell me about earthquakes in this area.
Talk a little more about the construction of buildings today. Can we rely on them being somewhat safe in terms of, downtown Seattle and the like? What do you think?
My daughter works in the library at UW. She says it's considered to be the most unsafe building on campus. What makes it unsafe? I would suppose, and this is really out of my area of expertise. I don't know what you do to make these buildings safe. Now, you probably live in
the library. Take all the books out.
They know. What would you do to try to make a building relatively more safe?
Well, I believe each jurisdiction is responsible for setting its own codes. I'm not a civil engineer, but I've hung out with them before. And I suppose the code quite literally specifies the acceleration in G's that the ground will be undergoing, and probably its periodicity as well. So the structural engineers and architects designing a building are designing to a particular standard. So they know that whether it's an 8-story building or 20 stories,
How much ground motion they designed it in a way that will accommodate that ground motion.
And it's legendary that the top floors of some of the buildings in Seattle, they will sway in the wind, or they get a small quake, and they'll move quite a bit up there.
Sure.
But that's what they're designed to do. It's just like a soft spring that absorbs the motion.
But don't ask me how you build a building that works. I don't know.
You avoid brick and masonry construction.
What?
You avoid brick and masonry construction.
Very rigid kinds of structure which give you no freedom of movement.
Another thing they do in terms of highways and columns is all the rebar in the columns used to be straight vertical. And after some of the California quakes, they also spiral rebar around the column as well. So even if the column starts fracturing, it's still kind of contained and has some load-bearing capability.
California's got to be the place where they've perfected, and we'll put that in quotes, but where they really have worked on those kinds of issues. It's an area of thought that we never think about in the Midwest, because you never confront that kind of construction demand at all. I mean, you just simply never see it. So what's the largest earthquake anybody's ever been in? Give me an idea.
The Northridge.
What?
The Northridge.
Oh, the one, no.
7, I think.
70?
6.7 or 7.3, I don't know, somewhere.
What happened?
Were you in it? California.
I was 50 or 60 miles from the epicenter, so there's a lot of damage in LA. I mean, there were gas fires all over the city, and all the power went out. But where I was at, it was pretty exciting. The S waves were really strong, and I didn't even know what they were called until today. And they were really close to the P waves, too, really close, and just followed each other. I woke up, it was 4:30 in the morning, I woke up to everything shaking. Everything was rattling really hard, and it had a really loud ga-ga-ga-ga-ga-ga-ga-ga sound. And I woke up, and then the S wave started. And I sat up on my bed, and I held on, because it was really going like this. So that was the most exciting one.
How long a period of time was this going on? A minute?
No, seconds. Well, I don't know, the S waves lasted a while. But I don't know. It seems like a long time when it's happening, but...
A couple things you've said are interesting. You're talking about sound, and you're talking about the fire. For example, the 1906 San Francisco earthquake, huge earthquake, about 25% of the damage is related to the earthquake. Now, the rest of it is related to fires. Because what happens, of course, is that your water mains are destroyed, and you can't get water to the places where you need to get water for to handle the fires. And so the fires essentially go unchecked until you get out far enough that you get to a point where the water mains are intact, and you can kind of almost set up fire lines. You think about forest fires where they go out and actually cut areas where they have a fire lane cut so they can kind of stop a fire. And so in a sense, it's what they had to do in San Francisco, get to a point where they had water and where they, in a sense, could almost, quote unquote, sacrifice the stuff on the other side of it, but they could stop it at that point because there they had water. On the other side, they didn't have any water. There wasn't enough pressure. Sound is an interesting thing. These Chilean earthquakes didn't have sound associated with them, and they eyewitness accounts talk about no particular comment about sound, but you've got ground motion, significant ground motion, a couple meters, and fairly long period of time, but no comment about sound. I'm really wondering why there is that difference. You would think if you're rattling buildings, of course, that would be pretty good.
Even when it's a really just a quick, like a small earthquake, you can hear it go, GUM!
Well, I'm reminded how flexible rock is. I mean, the apocryphal film of Galloping, or the Tacoma Narrows Bridge. And you see the bridge doing this, but you see that finally it's doing a lot of flexing, but it's done quite a bit of flexing before you see the cloud of dust blow off, which is actually the fracture of the pavement. I realize asphalt isn't the same as, you know, rock, but I would imagine that the sounds may be fracturing, and when there's no sound, there's less fracturing.
Now, the rocks are they can be relatively plastic in a way. They'll bend, they'll absorb a certain amount of energy. Obviously, they'll absorb energy because you get tremendous strain build up in rocks before they ultimately fail. Kind of interesting that the Richter scale is believed to top out at around 9, not because you stop measuring energy, but rocks simply cannot store energy beyond that kind of an energy level. They have to fail before that.
Got a question about the Richter scale to make sure I understand it. It's a measure of energy, so it might be a violent quake that's short, it might be a lower movement quake that takes a long time, but it's the energy released and not so much.
Yeah, it seems to integrate the waves and the time and to integrate that information in a way which then comes up with
the rate of energy release.
No.
The rate of energy
not
release.
Not power, energy.
Yeah. Well, I'm thinking rate of energy release. You can have it all released in one big bang, or it can be spread out with this rolling energy that's huge amount over a huge amount total, but relatively little in a short period of time.
People who live in the Seattle area, let's see, about June 26th or so, you had a pretty significant earthquake in the Seattle area. Jenny tells me she was in the library and felt it and yelled to somebody else that there was an earthquake. And of course, as I said, my daughter is petrified of earthquake. So she started yelling at somebody. And so both of them trying to get underneath the desk at the same time. I'm wondering about this image of my daughter and this other woman trying to get underneath the desk at the same time. And they're on the fourth floor, you know, and I'm thinking, on the fourth floor. I mean, I don't know. It's hard to know how I would react if I was in that kind of situation.
I was in one in Seattle. I mean, it must have been a year ago. I
up by Duval or someplace or at the center. But I was sitting in my basement and I heard some noises. Oh, I had a truck going up over the concrete pavement blocks in the street. And it went a little while longer. Oh, this is a real earthquake. And is it going to stop? No, it's not going to. That's what I got up and moved towards the basement doorway. By the time I got to there, it was disappearing already.
See the picture of the people in the gymnasium. Where did they go? Went right to the walls. They were running off the gymnasium floor towards the walls. A couple comments back here. Go ahead.
Well, we're from the Midwest, so we don't have as much experience with that. Although I know there was one in Wisconsin. I don't remember how many years ago. But we visited the Point Reyes National Seashore, where the Andreas Fault is, and it was really interesting to see all that. And we talked to some people who were hiking around in Sequoia Park and stuff about, and they were talking about the aftershocks, which I never realized occurred. I just thought it was, you know, one earthquake, and then it was, and for months afterwards, they have all these. So how does that, is there a period of time, or does it, you know, that this happens, or how do you know it's an aftershock and not just another earthquake? Or?
I think you know that there are aftershocks, and people who may know about this more about this than I, please correct me if I'm wrong, but I think you would know there are aftershocks because they're basically coming from the same area, and they are of equivalent energy or less energy than the original. And I would assume that you have them simply because you are releasing energy over a period of time, so you're continuing to release energy. It's not all. I think it's a little bit of a misnomer when James Sadd, the guy who's doing most of the narration, talked about it going once. I think there is slippage, but I think there continues to be slippage along a fault surface, and I think that's why until all that strain energy is released. You continue to get equivalent or smaller earthquakes from approximately the same position, and I think that's why you get aftershock. But maybe some people who know this better than I. Go ahead.
Yeah, me. You know, the question I'm wondering is, we've got Rainier and Mount St. Helens, and the data that you showed that there's a lot more activity under Mount St. Helens.
Yeah.
Does a volcano, the release from a volcano, reduce the pressure? And if we have a volcano eruption, we will not have an earthquake? Can one draw that conclusion or not?
No, I don't think so. The seismic activity below the earthquake is probably related not to faulting as much as movement of magma beneath that. And that movement of magma, I mean, it's not like it's water that's boiling down there. I mean, it's viscous, it's moving. And therefore, when it moves, it's creating energy or sending out shock waves. And the instrumentation is sensitive enough to pick that up. It's interesting to me to look at the difference in character of the, by the way, the reason it looks like it's flat on top is that the computer program that resolves the location of the epicenters has an arbitrary fix on it at 1 kilometer above sea level. So everything above that and down to that is all plotted at one point. Flat looks flat, but basically, it's interesting that Mount St. Helens seems to have deeper seismic activity, which I would imagine is a reflection of the molten material, the magma below it, being a much larger magma chamber than we would have at Mount Rainier. It's interesting to speculate about Mount Rainier, and by the way, there's a list here of recent Mount Rainier earthquakes. You'll be happy to know that there were none in June, but this gives the last 20, which goes back to October of 96, but you can get an idea of the location of them. But there's a lot of seismic activity just to the west of Mount Rainier, and it's deeper activity, probably related more to the I won't draw it again, but more to the plate going underneath, and it's the shallow activity at Rainier is probably related to magma movement, but the activity out to the west of Rainier is deeper and probably is related to failures in the plate and faulting going on in that plate as it plunges beneath, and that's out actually just a little bit to the west. Here's another diagram of that, and you can see here's Rainier, you can see the shallow earthquakes beneath it, and now you can see the deeper earthquakes out to the west of it.
That would be particularly reassuring if you live in Tacoma, is that right?
What?
It's reassuring if you live in Tacoma?
I guess. Yeah, I suppose. I don't know. I'm not reassured by any of this stuff. But it's fascinating to me that when I see this, what I think about is not so much the presence of molten material beneath Rainier, as you think about the potential for mudslides and that kind of activity coming off Rainier, because it's the seismic activity is really not centered, would suggest to me that it's not magmatic. It's related to something else. I just kind of wonder if you jiggle Rainier enough, whether you can stimulate the movement of mudslides off of the
That's the local concern there. Actually, there's a town that far from here, I believe, where they put up an alarm system, actually. Where they have at least an hour or two's warning before the river and the mud wipe out the town.
Yeah, great.
There's recently, within the past year or two, in the Seattle press, I guess they found fossilized or buried evidence of a high magnitude earthquake, which led to change in lake levels and everything else. What they allude to is they typically have shallow earthquakes in that area, but they referred to it as a subduction zone earthquake.
Yeah.
A deep one.
Deeper one.
So the building codes aren't as robust as they'd hoped, because the subduction earthquake apparently would be a bigger one when it happens.
I don't really think that you can develop a building code to handle.
The buildings were designed on the known history of earthquake, sure, and they found the evidence of a known earthquake that was bigger than they'd seen.
Sure.
So.
The question is, would you move to Seattle?
Would I move to Seattle?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
I know. I'd do it. I like Seattle, and I guess I wouldn't worry so much about the earthquakes. I mean, I suppose that's crazy, but I suppose anywhere you go, you have those kinds of potential for things. Like in Wisconsin, tornadoes are so common, and you know you have no control over tornadoes. And I've seen what they've done in towns around Wisconsin, and you know, and then there they are. You're in a space of seconds. You're totally wiped out. Totally wiped out as well. I don't necessarily have a fear of them, but you just have a tremendous respect, and you pay a lot of attention to the radio in the Midwest under certain weather conditions. You know, so you want to have enough warning that you get. But you know, tornadoes are doing much better about predicting now, and our weather capability there is better, and so I think earthquakes have a while to catch up with that. But I'll stop at that point. We went a little long, and I appreciate your attention. I'll hang around and answer questions if you'd like, or if you're interested in any of this material, you're welcome to look at it, and if you want to take it with you, that's fine, because I'm not going to carry it out of the village.
I've heard
that.
Could you review the ratio of the Richter scale? You went over that very briefly.
Okay, sure. Basically going from minus 2 up to a larger number. But for the sake of argument, just think about it in terms of going from like 2 to about 9. Mm-hmm. When you go from a magnitude 2 earthquake, which you can just barely feel, to a magnitude 3 earthquake, there's basically 30 times the energy from going from 2 to 3. 3 has about 30
yes.
times more.
And that was mentioned in the video.
Okay.
Then
when he goes from 2 to 4, he's going 30 times 30.
Okay, that's,
so that's
what I
900
wanted.
Times yes. more
and
energy.
He didn't say the 30 times 30 that I heard, but he did say the 900.
Yeah.
And I wondered.
That's where he's getting
it. So from when it goes from 2 to 3 to 4 to 5 to 6, it's 30 times 30 times 30
yes.
times 30. And so on.
So then.
So let's go from 2 to 5.
Yes.
It'd be 30 times 900, 27,000 times
yes.
more energy.
Yes. Okay, I've got it. All right, thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
We have a new clue. How does the laser light thing work?
What?
How does the laser light thing work when it showed the laser light on the reflectors?
How does the laser light work?
Yeah.
Is that what you're asking? I'm not hearing.
Yeah, how does that measure distance is what,
okay.
what he's asking.
Well,
about.
if you know the mm-hmm. speed of light,
mm-hmm.
okay, and you know the distance between where you
286,000 miles per second.
And coming back, you know that distance. I think they had it like, oh, I forget, what did you say, how far that was?
Oh,
a couple of kilometers
yeah.
across the valley.
9 kilometers.
Okay. Speed of light is, I think, 186,000 miles per second. And so if you know that distance in miles, you know when you started, when you sent the light energy out, and when you first received it back, you know that time. Okay. It's going to be a very, very short time, very short, but you have instrumentation able to measure that very short interval time.
And it has to be a laser light. It can't just be a light bulb.
It's got to be very focused.
Be, yeah.
It's a very narrow beam of light energy.
And just one color.
Yeah.
It's got to be one color, because it's confusing when our light bulb has many, many colors, light waves are confusing. If you just have one color, then you can separate out the light waves.
So you measure that, you know that distance, you know the time. So then you can compare it one day to the next, and if that distance is changing, then you know something is happening on that.
And they're able to generate one light using crystal.
Or else if you're in a large room that's dark, by snapping your fingers, you can tell if you're getting close to a wall or not. Same sort of thing by how long the echo takes in snapping your fingers. You can start telling how close you are to the wall. Only the laser is doing the same thing with light. They're essentially measuring the time.